Hosea chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. This is God's holy, infallible, and inerrant word. Hear this, you priests. Pay attention, you Israelites. Listen, O royal house. This judgment is against you. You have been a snare at Mizpah, a net spread out on Tabor. The rebels are deep in slaughter. I will discipline all of them. We'll end our reading there. Well, friends, I wanted to do some research this past week. I know that a number of you here are hunters, avid hunters, or beginner hunters. I would assume that if that is who you are, you've been looking at the calendar eagerly these days, waiting for open season, as the spring is just around the corner. But it wasn't big game that I was interested in this past week. Rather, it was trapping. Maybe you know something of trapping. Beaver, muskrat, otter, raccoon, squirrel. I wanted to learn about this particular branch of hunting. It's been around for a long time, especially in our own country, trapping. What I learned was pretty interesting. In Ontario, not only are you required to possess a trapping license if you want to set up traps and snares to catch these smaller animals like raccoons and squirrels and whatnot, but you also need to abide by a very elaborate code of rules and regulations. Let me just share a few of them with you. A person shall not trap for hire or for gain or the expectation of gain. You shall not kill, capture, or injure a game bird by means of a trap, or a baited line, or similar device. You shall not trap wildlife or a domestic animal by means of a body-gripping trap. I don't know what that is, but it sounds painful. So page after page, rule after rule, I'm not making this up. This was the code of conduct or body of legislation and laws that you have to abide by if you are going to be a trapper in our province of Ontario. You've got to know the rules, in other words. And you have to follow them. You've got to play fair. Well, interestingly, in our text in Hosea, the issue of idolatry and those caught up in it are likened to a small game trapper. But in this case, we're dealing with a trapper who doesn't play by the rules. He cheats. He lies. He scams. He deceives. A trapper who will do whatever it takes to trap you in its grip. All the rules are out the window when it comes to idolatry and those caught up in it. And that is how we need to see idolatry, as an enemy, as a sneaky enemy, brothers and sisters. We have to pay attention to its ways this evening. I hope to show you why. I hope to show you how we can do that, because identifying the enemy is half the battle, at least half the battle. Our text this evening gives us a window into the life of a nation and its people who have fallen to the destructive influences of idolatry. They've been trapped. They've been trapped. And hasn't this whole book of Hosea been, in many ways, a window into that tragic reality? Perhaps this would be as good a time as any to review the first four chapters, since it's been several months since we left off Hosea at the end of the summer. So let's do that as briefly as I can. We began by considering the context of the prophet himself. Hosea was a prophet in the northern kingdom of Israel, the 10 tribes under Jeroboam the first, who had separated from Judah in the south in the days of Solomon. Hosea stepped onto the scene at a time of deep and wicked spiritual decay among the people. But it was a decay that was masked by an outer veneer of prestige and prosperity. You see, God had been blessing the northern kingdom abundantly as far as those material realities were concerned. But Israel had turned her heart away from Yahweh and began serving Baal. And the whole land of the northern kingdom had turned into a carnival of idolatry. And so God had commanded, we saw back in chapter 1, God had commanded Hosea the prophet to go and take a prostitute for a wife and to have children with her. And God's intention in doing this with Hosea was at least twofold. He wanted to parade before the northern kingdom a flesh and blood embodied picture of the reality that their turning away from him amounted to nothing less than spiritual adultery. They had broken the covenant. But secondly, because God is not mocked, he would make this clear by having Hosea and his wife Gomer name their three children after three deepening judgments that were looming on the horizon for the northern kingdom. That was chapter 1. Chapter 2 was an indictment upon Israel's idolatry and Baal worship itself. We saw that this idolatry had degraded them, it had deceived them, and it was on the brink of destroying them as a people. Chapter 3 reintroduced us to Gomer, Hosea's unfaithful wife, and she had, we read, gotten herself into some trouble, and for whatever reason, there was a price over her head, and God commanded Hosea to pay that price, to redeem her back. To buy her back. We saw that God was painting a picture of his own covenantal love for his people, a love that redeems, that rescues, that reforms, that accomplishes its purposes, its saving purposes in the lives of those he has set his love upon. And finally, in chapter 4, we saw Israel's priests brought to the bar of God's judgment for their failure to lead God's people as they were supposed to have done. There was no knowledge of God in the land, and it was in large part because the priests, the leadership, had neglected its duties. The people themselves, we saw, were not off the hook either. They were guilty as well. They had followed. They were led, but they had followed. Chapter 4 ended with another indictment upon Israel for her idolatry, which is perhaps best summed up in verse 12 of chapter 4, where we read, "My people consult a wooden idol, and a diviner's rod speaks to them." How sad. A spirit of prostitution leads them astray. They are unfaithful to their God. You may have noticed that I have passed over something in this review. Because as heavy as the indictments were, every now and then, apart even from chapter 3, every now and then between chapter 1 and up to the point we are now, we've been jolted, as it were, by unexpected glimmers of gospel hope. God pointing his people forward to a time when the marriage would be restored. It would be restored under the Messiah King, who is, of course, Jesus, the Redeemer of God's elect. We've seen that this book is full of gospel, if you want to put it that way. The good news is there, but it's set against the backdrop of the very bad news of the northern kingdom's adultery and desertion of Yahweh. Well, now I think we're ready to jump into chapter 5. And I've already mentioned that our text gives us a window into the life of a nation and a people who have fallen to the destructive influence of idolatry. They've been ensnared. They've been trapped. The first thing that we see is that idolatry is malignant. The NCI defines malignancy this way: a term for diseases in which abnormal cells divide without control and can invade nearby tissues and spread to other parts of the body. And when we turn to Hosea, we see that this is just what has happened in the northern kingdom. Let me explain. Let's read verses 1 through 2 once more. Hear this, you priests. Pay attention, you Israelites. Listen, O royal house. This judgment is against you. You have been a snare at Mitzpah, a net spread out on Tabor. The rebels are knee-deep in slaughter. And I'll stop reading there. And let's break this down to see just how malignant idolatry has demonstrated and proven itself to be. Well, first we see that idolatry is something that spreads. You'll notice that everyone is being summoned to God's bar. The priests had been singled out in chapter 4. The royal leadership, the royal house, will be singled out in chapter 7. But here in chapter 5 and verse 2, everyone's on the end of the judgment, because idolatry had spread. And we have to hear this judgment in light of what we've already considered back in chapter 4 when the priests were brought to the bar of God. The priests bore a unique guilt for their idolatrous ways and the idolatrous state of the nation. They were to be the guarders, the preservers of God's holy law and His ways. And they had failed, and so they were held accountable for that back in chapter 4. We saw that, and we hear a similar indictment upon irresponsible priests in the prophet Malachi and chapter 2, verses 7 through 8. We read this: "For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth. For he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts. But you have departed from the way. You have caused many to stumble at the law. You have corrupted the covenant of Levi," says the Lord of hosts. And the priests in Hosea's day in Israel were no less guilty of having caused many to stumble. The idolatrous practices and ways had spread in their malignancy. They had spread from priest to people. And everyone was infected. They were all caught up in it, because that's what idolatry does. It spreads. It's malignant. But second, we see the malignancy of idolatry in its, what we could say, hijacking of something good and feeding off of it and eventually ruining it. We're going to see that here in a minute. Idolatry is like a parasite. And a parasite needs a host to feed upon, doesn't it? And idolatry will find what is good and will latch on and will suck the life right out of it. And we need to look no further than Mitzpah and Tabor to see this parasitic malignancy playing out, friends. Now, I think two things are at play in Hosea's use of Mitzpah and Tabor. And the first is this: Mitzpah and Tabor were places of prominence and note in Israel's history. We sang about Tabor tonight. Psalm 89. Well, we'll look at Tabor first. Mount Tabor was about 5 miles west of Nazareth. So it was in the north. It stood just under 2,000 feet. Some of you may have been to Blue Mountain in southern Ontario. You may be a skier and you may have gone there. Well, Mount Tabor is just a few hundred feet taller than Blue Mountain in southern Ontario. It's not too tall, but it was a very prominent location for the people of God. In fact, early tradition holds that this was the mountain, Mount Tabor. It was the Mount of Transfiguration in the Gospels. We don't know for sure, but there is an early tradition that holds that. But what we do know is that in Israel's early history, Deborah and Barak, in the time of the judges, defeated Sisera with, I think it was 10,000 troops upon Mount Tabor. It's a place of the victory of God's people over his enemies. And it soon became a prominent place in the life of God's people. Under Solomon, Mount Tabor was an administrative district. And again, we read about Mount Tabor in Psalm 89. But with the tribal split, Tabor in the north was severed from the south. And under the successive rules of one wicked king after another, Tabor had transformed into a den of idolatry. By Hosea's day, you see, the place that had once reflected Israel's glorious privilege and status and beauty as the covenant people of God had been hijacked through idolatry and turned into a carnival of Baal worship. From glory to shame. Well, that's Tabor. What about Mitzpah? Or Mitzpah. The Mitzpah referred to in Hosea is very likely the city, Mitzpah, by the Jordan Valley. There are a number of Mitzpahs in the Bible. But it is very likely the city that's being referred to here by the Jordan Valley. It's also in the north. And it was here in Mitzpah that Samuel had led the people in a decisive victory over the Philistines, which was a real confirmation of God's being on his people's side. And it was in Mitzpah that Saul was anointed as king over Israel. But like Tabor, by Hosea's day, Mitzpah had morphed into a carnival of idolatry. So what's clear here in verse 1 with these references to Mitzpah and Tabor is that Israel's glory had been turned into shame, because this is what idolatry does. It had found its host, the majestic Mount Tabor, the sacred city of Mitzpah, and it had latched on and sucked the life right out of them. As Israel exchanged the truth of God for a lie. But there's even more to the reference, I think, of Mitzpah and Tabor here in verse 1. Mitzpah in the Hebrew means literally watchtower. It's the word for watchtower. And I think the prophet Ezekiel is a good place to turn as we consider what God might be saying here through this word. And we read in Ezekiel 3, 17 through 19, these words, "Son of man," God is speaking to him, "I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, hear a word from my mouth, and you better give them warning from me. When I say to the wicked, 'You shall surely die,' and you give him no warning, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. I have made you a watchman, Ezekiel." And back to Hosea, we see that the people were accountable for their descent into idolatry, but the leaders held a special or a significant portion of guilt in that they had allowed it to happen. They had led the people. The people had followed, but they had led the people. They didn't warn, they didn't rebuke, they didn't speak the truth because they were too caught up in the entanglements of idolatry. They should have been watching out for the people of God. And they had failed. And with Tabor, perhaps we have an even deeper level of indictment. Tabor, which means in Hebrew high place or lofty place, may be pointing to how the leaders had put themselves or positioned themselves over the people and used that position to ensnare them in idolatry. And how high a place they once stood as the covenant people of God, and how low a place they had sunk to in turning away from Yahweh. They had exchanged the truth of God for a lie, worshiping and serving the creature rather than the Creator, who alone is blessed forever. Who are you worshiping tonight? You haven't made that exchange, have you? I hope not. There is only one who is blessed forever, and that is God, revealed fully in His Son, Jesus Christ. The way, the truth, and the life. We see here through this window a people who had been snapped up, who had been ensnared. And had their glory turned to shame. Well, are we here tonight any less susceptible to being ensnared by that same malignant idolatry? Are we in a safer position than Israel was because we no longer bow to sticks and stones? Are we immune from that malignancy because we're in the church? This was the church. Have you visited our own parliament buildings ever? Or read about our own Parliament buildings, if you go into the boardroom of, or outside the boardroom of the official opposition, you'll find inscribed above the one of the doors the words from 1 Peter 2:17, "Fear God, honor the King." You could go to the Peace Tower and you can read Psalm 72:8 inscribed there, "He shall have dominion from sea to shining sea." Or Proverbs 29:18, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." These are our own government buildings. And I've only mentioned a few of the many biblical references that are inscribed there. But where is our nation's vision today? Are we fearing God and honoring the King? Do we even care about Messiah's dominion from sea to sea? Have we not, as a nation, been ensnared by a malignant idolatry that has sucked the life right out of us? And people might think it's funny to parade their signs on the hill, "In pot we trust." But God is not mocked. Idolatry is dangerous. It destroys people and it destroys nations. I know a number of you here have spent time in Scotland, and others perhaps. Well, where is the old glory of Knox and Melville and Henderson and Cameron and Geddes today? Are they honored in Scotland? What about John Knox's burial site? They've paved over it so he could have a parking spot. And what about theological seminaries that were once bastions of truth, established through hours and hours and hours of prayer and grounded in orthodox teaching? How many of these seminaries have now been destroyed by a malignant idolatry that bows the knee to Darwin, that honors political correctness above God? Friends, we need to behold and beware this picture in Hosea. Idolatry is a malignant force, an abnormal growth on what was once good and beautiful, but it spreads and it spreads and it spreads and it sucks the life out of it and it decays it. Well, not only do we see in our text that idolatry is malignant, we see that idolatry is merciless. It's sneaky, it's malicious, it's enslaving. Its goal is to keep you away from the only true God. Notice the imagery here in Hosea. "You have been a snare at Mitzpah, a net spread out on Tabor." And to be sure, it is not idolatry itself being addressed here. It is the people. The people have taken idolatry into their hearts. And through them, it has spread and ensnared. That's where idolatry is rooted, and that's where idolatry festers and grows in the heart, in the human heart. As Calvin said, it is our hearts that are idol factories. The mountainous regions around Mitzpah and Tabor were known to have attracted hunters. and trappers. This imagery would have been immediately apparent to Hosea's audience in his day. God is likening here, in many ways, idolatry to entrapment. Merciless entrapment, and is precisely what has been happening at the time. The people would come up to Mizpah and Tabor, possibly they were pilgrimage sites. We're not 100% sure, but people would come up. We know that. People would come up. Some of these travelers would be devoted to Yahweh. Others would have already begun straying in their hearts, looking for something new. But the point is that everyone who made it up to Tabor or Mizpah fell into the trap. That's what is being said here in Hosea. The trap had been set in large part by the priests, and the people just needed to step on it, and they did. And they were ensnared and entangled. This is what idolatry can do. It lures you in. It entices you, and before you know it, you've taken the bait. And you're hamstrung. But you're so allured by idolatry's deceptive, enslaving, ensnaring, and blinding power that you don't even realize that you've been debilitated. You're in a net. You're trapped. You might think you're free, but you're not. It's a snare. The northern kingdom had turned around, had turned to the surrounding nations, pagan nations, and learned their ways. They weren't content with Yahweh and His pure word. They wanted something new. They wanted something different. They wanted something like everyone else had. But what do we read back in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 9? Just before entering the promised land, they are commanded, the people are commanded this: when you come into the land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not learn to follow the abominations of these nations. And even after the land had begun to be possessed under Joshua, Joshua himself commands the people this: therefore, take careful heed to yourselves, that you love the Lord your God, or else if indeed you do go back and cling to the remnant of these nations, these that remain among you, and make marriages with them and go into them and they to you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps to you, and scourges on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. And the northern kingdom had failed to heed that warning. And they had learned the ways of the pagan nations around them, the snare. And now they themselves were a snare and a trap. You become what you worship. You become what you worship. Their idols became a snare to them, and now they themselves have become the snare. Well, every time you're tempted to turn to someone or something other than God to do for you what only God Himself can do, remind yourself of this: I'm walking into a trap. I might not see the net, or you might not see the net. In fact, it will probably be hidden under a promise of freedom and happiness. But it's a lie. It's a lie. But what do you do if it's too late? What if you've stepped on that net? What if you've taken the bait? What if you're sitting here this evening and you know or you're seeing that you've been hamstrung? Perhaps it's pornography, perhaps it's sports, perhaps it's your career. Perhaps it's money. Perhaps it's just a lust for power and ambition or whatnot. Perhaps it's even academics, whatever it might be. Maybe you've seen this evening that you've stepped on the net. What do? You turn to Jesus Christ. You turn to Jesus Christ. Do you want deliverance? Satisfaction, holiness, you turn to Christ because nothing or no one else can deliver on that promise to make you satisfied in your soul. As Augustine said, and I love these words, "Oh God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." As Jesus called broken, contrite, weary sinners, "Come to me, you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Whether you've turned to Him already or whether you will turn to Him tonight for the first time, look to Jesus Christ alone for deliverance from the enslaving power of idolatry. Idolatry traps and enslaves. Jesus Christ gives freedom. Freedom to serve God without fear. Have you come to the Son for freedom? Or do you think you're free already without Jesus? During His own earthly ministry, Jesus had an encounter with a group of people divided as to who He really was. Many said, "I don't need Him." Others said, "I do need Him." Listen to how Jesus speaks to this group of people. Then Jesus said to those Jews who believed Him, "If you abide in My word, you are My disciples indeed, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And they answered Him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been in bondage to anyone. How can you say you will be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." Isn't that interesting? We have never been in bondage to anyone. What are we witnessing here? In the throes of idolatry, as the covenant people of God are being deceived and destroyed and degraded. Idolatry is merciless. Jesus is merciful. We've seen that idolatry is malignant. Idolatry is merciless. And finally, idolatry is mortal. Idolatry kills. We read in verse 2, the very end, God says, I will discipline all of them. The priests, the royals, the people, no one will escape God's discipline. I will discipline all of them, says God. For the elect, it will be redemptive. For the reprobate, it will be purely judicial. But for everyone, it will be catastrophic. Because this is what idolatry results in, friends. Death and destruction. But it's going to be redemptive discipline. For God's elect. And I want to begin to wrap up with that thought in mind. We considered the theme of discipline in the life of the Christian, God's discipline in the life of the Christian, last Lord's Day, and we saw that it was our Heavenly Father's means of making us more like Himself. It was a token, it is a token of His love, it's a mark of our identity as His children. And we recall that back in chapter 3, God had declared His own covenantal love to His unfaithful bride, a love that redeems and rescues and reforms. And we see that even this far into the book of Hosea, we're up to chapter 5, even this deep in idolatry, that covenantal love has not been withdrawn. It's still there. We'll see that as we go on. So you and I need to take note and take heed as we look at this through this window into idolatry and its effects, a malignancy. Something that is merciless and something that is mortal. And we need to shun it. And look to our high priest Jesus to keep us as far away from it as we need to be. And resting in God, resting in His covenantal love. We need to respond to God's love by giving all that we have back to Him. And I close with the words of the Apostle Paul from Romans chapter 8. And if you haven't memorized these words, I would encourage you to do so this week. The Apostle Paul writes this, "For I am persuaded that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus our Lord." Nothing. Not even a malignant, merciless, and mortal idolatry, as the book and the prophet Hosea will continue to point out as we make our way through this with the time that God gives us.